Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Thanks for that extra long lead-in as I was having some technical difficulties. Welcome back to Full Service Radio. I'm Spike Jurdy, your host for Origins, and I'm joined today, very excited to have this conversation with Andrew Barenberg, the Policy Director for the National Young Farmers Coalition. Did I get that right?
You got it right.
Awesome. Welcome, Andrew. Thanks for being here. I'm really excited to talk to you because I think you have some insight and kind of a view on a lot of the things as someone in my position who deals with farmers on a daily basis. Some of the bigger issues and questions that we're dealing with in our food system. And I'm really excited to get your perspective on that, some of the work you're doing with the coalition, and ultimately, I think, hopefully we'll be talking about where food is headed in this country. But first, just tell us a little bit about the coalition, your role as policy director, and what you do there and what the coalition's all about.
Great, thanks. And I'm thrilled to be here. I'm a big fan, and I live just right down the street, so this is perfect. So the coalition has been around since 2010. We were founded by a group of young farmers in the Hudson Valley that came together, understood they were facing a lot of the same challenges, many of which were either unique to this new generation of farmers or simply more acute than of generations past. So they got together, they started getting organized, actually found out that there were other pockets of young farmers around the country in Michigan, Washington, that had already started to kind of fly the flag, so to speak. Since then, we have grown into a national organization. We've got 40 chapters now, all led by farmers in 30 different states. So we advocate for farmers and organize in three different ways. We do policy advocacy. That's obviously the focus of my job here in D.C. We provide business services for young farmers, so we train them up on things like food safety regulations, business planning, helping them get access to credit. And then we organize, right? So it's about creating a network for people, either socially or skill sharing, just to kind of create that fabric and that social solidarity that's so important, especially in more rural areas for young people.
Right. So I think it's probably almost too obvious to say that being a farmer in this day and age is tough, but can you talk a little bit about the particular challenges of being a young farmer here in this country, 2018?
Yeah, for sure. It's always been tough, right? It's especially tough now for a few reasons. I mean, one is the cost of farmland. So that's the top challenge young farmers across the country face, regardless of whether they grew up on a farm, whether they didn't. And it's because in my adult lifetime, since 2004, farmland prices in the U.S. have more than doubled. So it's not as though farmers are necessarily making more money, but at the same time, land is more expensive. It's harder to make that cash flow work. But there are other, new challenges. Student loan debt is now the top challenge that we find from surveying our young farmers across the country. And that's, I mean, with the cost of college rising, it's a generational problem for us that we're just starting to wrap our heads around.
Is there anything? Well, my thing is, like, I'm in Maryland. Now I'm kind of looking at Maryland, Pennsylvania, Virginia. Maryland, though, take Maryland as a small state. We are about 2 million acres of arable land. About 1 million of that is actively farmed. We're dominated by a kind of a three-headed monster of commodity ag, which is soy, corn, which is kind of one head, but and chicken, and, commodity chicken production or confined chicken production. And the farmers you represent, I guess, are they part of that world, or are they, or is this, are we talking about a different kind of breed a farmer?
Yeah, it depends. So there are obviously multi-generation operations that have a lot of which have gotten big over time, right? Acquired a bigger land mass over generations. We certainly see a surge of new people coming in. And of course, with commodities, you can't just start on that scale. You can't get a line of credit for $1.5 million to buy the land, the infrastructure required to make it work. So we're finding young farmers more often are starting with those smaller operations. They're capitalizing on the increased demand for local food. They're diversifying their revenue streams, their crops, and starting small in part because land is so expensive. So you got to start with the high value crops, selling direct to consumer, farmers market CSAs, and thanks to chefs like you, to restaurants.
One of the things we still seem to be wrestling with is the fact that small-scale farms, the ones that you know that sometimes I buy from, have trouble making money in general, right? Is that one thing that I read is that most of these farms operate at a loss. They're supported by off-the-farm jobs that the family takes just to keep farming. And I'm wondering, you know, obviously in my daily life, I'm thinking, like, how long is this even going to, you know, use that word sustainable. It's like, how long is this going to last? What do you think the answer is? To those kind of, so you've got this barrier to entry, which is cost of land. You've got this other situation with a lot of people have school debt. What about the basic economics of making a small farm work in this day and age?
Yeah, it's really tough. And actually, we're seeing it happen where it's really the middle that's hollowed out, right? So you've seen farms get bigger and fewer, right, over the last several decades. But then you've also, most of the new farms coming in, are that very small scale. And so the big question, right, for all of us to wrap our heads around is how do we rebuild that middle scale where a lot of families used to make it, and it really used to underpin a lot of these communities that now are completely hollowed out. I mean, a lot of it is just helping these smaller farms grow into bigger operations in a, you know, in a sustainable manner. We did a national survey of young farmers last year, farmers in the U.S. under 40. One of the exciting findings was that we found that for every year they'd been in business, they were making more money. So that's exciting because they're getting better as yes. as they go, right? And that's, they're growing the right way.
So who's farming and what they're farming and where they're farming? Why does it even matter? I mean, there's a question of like, and I'm kind of asking, you know, from the other side a little bit, but we can't not ask, like, what does it even matter? Why would it be important to bring young farmers and support young farmers? What, to bring young farmers in and to support them?
Well, I mean, the biggest answer is that, I mean, the food's got to come from somewhere, right? And so who grows it, who gets to eat it is, you know, a foundational question for our communities.
But you clearly believe, you know, based on the work that you're doing, that it matters.
I do.
And that... So why?
I do. It matters for our food system, for our economy, for our national security. I mean, the average age of farmers has been rising at a steady clip. It's almost 60 years old right now. And that fluctuates a little bit state to state, but for the most part, that trend line is scary. For every 6 farmers over the age of 65, there's only 1 under 35.
Wow.
Right. And the amount, it's not even just the age, but it's the amount of farmland that's being stewarded by those older farmers. So a third of U.S. farmland is currently being farmed by someone 55 to 64, and then another third by someone 65 years or older. And so that's two-thirds of U.S. farmland that's going to need a new farmer in the next 5, 10, 20 years. And like who that farmland goes to matters a great deal. Especially, we're starting to see a lot more like speculative buying of farmland. So in the last... I mean, this is a new issue in the last 5 years. The holding income on farmland is actually higher than the productive capacity of that.
What does that mean exactly?
So in other words, a lot of like private interests can make more money just buying the farmland than a farmer can farming it. And so you see a lot of farmland being bought up in a speculative fashion, and those owners don't necessarily care what's being grown on it or if anything's grown on it. So that's a huge concern, right? I mean, we want farmland to be owned by the people growing the food on it. They're the ones that will have the stake and be the best stewards of that farmland.
So you mentioned that a lot of your work is around you know, you're the policy director and advocacy here in D.C., and I can't not talk about where a lot of that seems to happen. We're talking about farms and actually the food that we eat, which is a farm bill, right?
Mm-hmm.
I haven't ever had a chance to talk about that here, so would you be cool, like, letting us know a little bit about, like, what the farm bill is? Because I think there's some confusion about that. And then I'd love to get into a little bit more about the ways in which it kind of affects and influences and determines, you know, farming in this country and what we eat.
Yeah, and I'll try not to geek out too much.
Geek
on,
out.
Keep
that's
it top
what,
level.
That's
but,
why we're here.
So farm bill happens about once every 5 years and determines almost every aspect of not only agriculture, but food generally. So that includes food access. Generally, about 80% of the dollars spent every farm bill are on the nutrition title. So that's food stamps, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. The other, you know, quarter, give or take, is around agriculture. So that includes, you know, big things like crop insurance, you know, risk management tools for farmers. That includes research, marketing support, and for groups like ours, that means like investments in training new farmers, lines of credit for all types of farmers, operating loans. This is a really, so the current farm bill expires September of this year, right? So Congress is working on a new one right now. What's interesting is the last farm bill was written in pretty good times, right? Commodity prices were pretty high. Farmers were making money. That is not the case this time. We're in a five-year slump right now where farm net incomes are down 50%. More than half of farm families are expected to lose money this year. We're in a pretty dangerous place. And obviously that puts a lot of extra pressure on the members of Congress that are writing this thing. The stakes are really high for us because, as I mentioned, all that farmland that's getting ready to transition, we're calling for investments to protect it, to conserve it. And then, I mean, the other piece for us is making sure that new growers, that young farmers can access all of these programs, right? So it's not enough right now for Congress to just write the checks for these programs. They have to make sure that they're equitably accessed by all farmers. And of course, you know, kind of given the size disparity, there are tons of big farms out there in every state, really, that young people often get outcompeted for those precious dollars.
To be on big land and get big money. Or is that not fair?
No, I mean, that's fair. And you know, also to be fair, those larger farms are generating tons of economic output. And tons of food. So of course, you know, a lot of those programs are going to be geared toward supporting those farms.
But what do you think the farm bill, are there specifics that you'd like to see in the farm bill that would help young farmers?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned training, but we're fighting for scraps when it comes to investments in training new farmers. And especially as we see a lot of so-called first-generation farmers, young people who are willing to come back to the land, especially to rural communities that desperately need young people, we have to have the investments in training them, in helping them, like, dial in their business plans. 'Cause, you know, as you said, it's hard enough to want to farm, and farming is really hard. So you've got to be motivated, but you also have to have that business model just perfectly dialed in because the margins are so slim. Another big title of the farm bill is conservation, right? So incentivizing better farming practices that lead to better natural resource outcomes, better watersheds, cleaner water, that kind of thing. I mean, we're really fighting for investments in those and to make sure that beginning farmers have access to them.
So given, you know, what you're telling us about kind of current agricultural economy, how tough it is, and our current political economy, what are your hopes for the farm bill right now, for this next one?
Well, they say there are two types of farm bills. There's the revolutionary kind and there's the evolutionary kind. The mantra on the Hill right now is this is a status quo farm bill. This is an evolutionary type of farm bill. In part, just given the like macro political budget climate, it's tough to call for significant, you know, overwhelming investments in things like protecting farmland. So we're hoping to to play a little defense on the gains we've made in the last farm bill. But I mean, it's a squeaky wheel gets the grease type of game. And so we're out here sounding the alarm on these types of trends, because we might not have enough time to wait before the next farm bill. And it's a little crazy, you know, I mean, the mantra on the Hill is like, there's no extra money to go around. Right. And so, you know, we're calling for an extra, you know, $10 million here and there. And it's a little surreal after, you know, passing a $1.5 trillion tax cut. Right. I mean, there's a huge disconnect, but we're doing the best we can. And thankfully, we've got a lot of older farmers that are advocating on our behalf, a lot of consumers, a lot of people that also have a stake in the food system that are fighting right along with us.
I hate to ask you this, but who is our Secretary of Agriculture right now?
It's a man named Sonny Perdue. He's the former governor of Georgia. And he's actually been in the ag sector for a long time. He owns some agribusiness companies, or I guess used to own. You have to kind of divest when he becomes Secretary of Ag. And, you know, I mean, to be fair, a lot of his messaging is about supporting the next generation. He talks a lot about modernizing customer service at USDA, which is something that we, you know, as the millennial farmers have been pestering USDA for a long time, like put more stuff on the internet, develop apps, like make it easier to get to, because, you know, we don't always want to have to fill out a paper application and drive it into our office, right?
Right.
Should make it a little bit easier.
Is there a way that your work, whether it's on the Farm Bill or some other policy work or advocacy, ends up as something that you or that I would recognize on my plate, or affecting the way that I eat or what's available to me? I'd love for us to be able to kind of connect, you know, what you're telling us about Farm Bill and what happens at, you know, in government to what we end up being able to eat or not eat, or what it costs or something like that.
Yeah, and especially for chefs, right, that are
right. Sure.
That are looking at a lot of more specialty things. I mean, the research title of the Farm Bill determines, you know, where those research dollars are spent. So there are some programs like the Sustainable Ag Research and Education Initiative that funds farmers to try out, you know, new breeds of squash, right? Or like new practices, maybe stacking different crops on top of each other, integrating livestock, like those types of things that you probably see a lot of your farmers doing. You know, a lot of the research behind that comes from the Farm Bill, a very, very small slice of the Farm Bill. But that's just an example. You know, some of the work that some of our like coalition partners are trying to advocate for is kind of making open source more of the seed research that gets done.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I mean, you guys talk about that all the time, right? This like breeding flavor back into certain varieties, making things scalable so that you can bring the cost down of certain specialty crops that you love to cook. That stuff translates directly.
Right. I mean, for me, I've kind of like my very short, I guess the way I'm thinking about it is that if we're not buying from small farms and some of these younger farmers that are in our region, they're not going to be in business. They're not going to be around. And we'll kind of have seeded our food system and what we eat to something else.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, there's almost a daily urgency around like, we need to get more dollars back to growers. My way of doing it is to purchase from them. You're working in another way where you get other resources, I think, to me, in front of them, you know, and that's crucial too. One of the most encouraging things I'm seeing is that we're now, a lot of the farms that I've been working with now for 10, 15, 20 years are becoming multi-generational, which is something, you know, when I started out and I was buying from farmers in my neck of the woods up in Baltimore County and in southern Pennsylvania, amazing folks, and they've been at it long enough, and now their sons and daughters are coming back to the farm. And these are, you know, small-scale, relatively produce farms, some of them organic. And it's amazing to see. I have to say, like, the things that I could point to that are, like, encouraging, that would be one specific thing that I could say, like, young people are finding their way back to these farms. You know, they are established. These are the ones that have been successful over time, demonstrated profitability. But I have to say, like, I mean, that's why one of the reasons I was happy to talk to you is because this is something that's important to us, and I've connected it with the fact, or with the our ability to ever to have this food or not.
Yeah, and I actually got to meet some of those farmers that you're talking about at that producer's dinner, and I could tell, you know, I mean, that you're the real deal talking to them, because they kept talking to me about how important it was to have that. You know, it's never a guaranteed revenue stream, but to have that support, especially when times are kind of tough, to know that you're going to be there to support what they're doing and to buy their food if they keep growing it in a way that you like. You know, it's so important. Right. I'm here on the political side, like advocating for policies, right? And it gets wonky in a hurry and can feel pretty disconnected. But it's so important to have consumers, you know, food producers, chefs, that are speaking the same language, right? And that's, I think, what's created a lot of these opportunities for young farmers to enter the market and fill those niches and then grow into the scale and viability where they could imagine passing on that farm to their kids. You know, I mean, one of those demographic trends that we talk about a lot of that comes from the 80s farm crisis, right? There was an entire generation of farm parents that told their kids, like, man, get the hell out of here. Like, go do something else. There's nothing here for you. And fortunately, we're seeing a generation come back, but a lot of them are starting from scratch.
Can you help me place this? One of my... I was really young. I don't know when this was. I was in high school. And there was... And, it, you know, I was reminded from the march this past weekend, but one of the first memories I have of coming to DC was for a farm. Farmers drove their tractors to DC. Mm-hmm.
The tractorcade.
When was that?
That, gosh.
Was that like 76? Does that sound
The right? First one might have been, I believe there was another one in the mid 80s. And that was, that was when commodity prices were really
right.
Bottoming out, and particularly dairy.
Yes.
I come from Vermont, the dairy state, and it's amazing the amount, the sheer scope of farms that were lost during that time.
So I have this memory. I came down here because my idea was, I'm pretty sure I was in high school, and it's like, I have to cover this for my, those are air quotes, I had to cover this for my high school paper. But there was something about it that just, like, I was just moved to, and I came down and I talked to these farmers who were out on the mall with their tractors, and it was really an amazing moment.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it's really amazing to think about and see pictures of. I was, you know, a little infant at the time, probably. And thankfully, I mean, things haven't quite gotten that bad again. Mm-hmm. But I'd love to imagine that there are enough farmers out there that could get pissed off again enough to drive their damn tractors all the way here. Because it's amazing to think about, you know, I mean, just the logistics of doing something like that, and then that type of demonstration and what that symbolism means.
Right.
You know, on a smaller scale, I've seen this even in my lifetime, like, you see farmers dumping milk on the state capitol lawn, right, to protest.
Let's take a quick detour, because I'm really interested, now that you mentioned Vermont, and my one experience on a farm was working on a dairy farm in Vermont, and... What is going on? Can you give me I'd love to get a snapshot of, because dairy is something that's really important to us, and I think those farmers among many are having a really hard time of it right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's mirrored what you see across the country, right? The only farms that have made it or are making it are the ones that have consolidated to the point where they can make those ends meet. Most of them are operating at a loss. The cost of production from milk is above what they can sell it for. And what's scary too is that...
Why does that happen? How do we get to a place where...
Well, it's a global marketplace at this
right.
point, right? And so there's always someone that can make it cheaper. And now that you can ship much, much further, you're competing on a global scale. You're competing with dairy farmers from New Zealand And so that level of scale is impossible for that mid-sized, family
right.
producer to do. And especially in states like Vermont, like, farms just don't get that big, right? We've got mountains and hills
right.
and not endless flat pasture to graze on. And so I think what you're seeing now is a lot of, you know, an appreciation for that. Like, maybe that's not the battleground we should be trying to compete on.
Which one? Milk?
Or just like that global marketplace for right. commodity crops.
Right.
And so the farms that are making it and are making a go of it are, you know, selling locally, that are bottling their own milk, distributing it within the community. And in fact, in the last census of agriculture, Vermont was one of the few states to actually add farms instead of lose them. And that's because, you know, you have a lot of smaller farms that are filling that demand.
It's scary. I'm working with some growers in Pennsylvania who have dairy, and they're talking about co-ops, and you know, whoever their processor is like saying, like, we're picking up today, but I don't know if we're going to be picking up. I don't know when the next pickup is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, these are farmers, and they don't have any other options. You know, it's like get rid of the herd. And even when I was in Vermont, I was in Cornwall and in Addison County and a big dairy county. But even back then, it's going back into the 80s, there were farms that were going over to Christmas trees.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I was, you know, there's like that guy used to be a dairy farmer. And now he's got Christmas trees on his land. And I guess is there still a buyout for dairy farmers?
Well, I mean, the adding the Christmas trees thing is, I mean, you see a lot of dairy starting to diversify that way.
Well, these guys were selling their herds, like getting out of it.
Yeah, then, right. Like the dairy farm that I grew up next to, and like my first jobs were stacking hay bales in the loft, right? Like the farm is still there, but the herd that's on that land that's being milked is owned by someone else, right? And he's starting to go into things like Christmas trees, you know, raspberries, you pick, pumpkins, and this and that, like trying to just support himself to maybe then his kids old enough to start buying back that herd.
Is it weird that seems sad to me? I don't know.
No, it's not at all weird. Yeah. I mean, it's a tragedy, and especially when you think about just the amount of knowledge and wisdom that might be lost, like the kind of the cultural aspect of it could get hollowed out. You know, I've in Vermont, we have a saying that, you know, Vermont without farms would still be a great place, but it wouldn't be Vermont. Right. And that's, I think a lot of people are starting to grapple with that. And where we start to get somewhere, I mean, shoot, there's only like 3 million farmers in the U.S. now.
Right.
Right. Tiny fraction.
Right.
So, of course, you can't, like, that's not a powerful enough block of people to really get anything done. And so when we start moving the needle is when we get consumers sounding the alarm. And when we get, you know, just community members that say, Jesus, there used to be, you know, 5 different farms on this dirt road alone, right? And now there is either one or there are none. And the, you know, the kind of knock-on impacts that has on other businesses in the community is just, I mean, it's, you can see it driving through some of these places.
So given how hard it is to be a farmer, and you were a farmer, right? You've done it, and now you're as knowledgeable as anybody I've ever talked to about, you know, what's going on out there. Can you make a case as put on your advocacy hat here and make a case for a young person to become a farmer?
Yeah, and let me be clear, I don't know anything, right?
Wow.
And there are, you know, a lot of elders that know a hell of a lot more than me. I mean, there are, it's really hard, of course, but the rewards are incredibly rich, and you can make a living despite the difficulties. And I think, especially if we can solve this land access issue, there is the opportunity to build generational wealth for people, right? You can have that bedrock legacy and start to piece it together over time. And so that's attractive. But also, I mean, shoot, man, like working outside with your hands, like creating something at the end of the day, I think that's especially attractive to people from my generation. You know, I mean, I went to college and graduated the year of the financial collapse, right? So all of a sudden, we're looking out at the job market and just the general economy and realizing like how much of it is the bullshit house of cards, right? And
right.
So I think that's one reason, and I don't want to overstate this, but I think that's one reason that you see a lot of people looking around for something more like tangible and tactile that they can really sink their energy into.
Are you, we're going to kind of, I'll let you have the last word. But one thing I want to know is, are you hopeful? Like knowing what you know, from the policy side and the farmers that you talk to and the economic realities of what it means to be a small scale farmer or any farmer in this country, are you hopeful for young farmers, and then I think more broadly for our, you know, for our food system.
Yeah, I'm hopeful. I mean, I like I work for the best constituency in the world, right? I mean, the farmers that I know are the smartest people that I know, right? And I think there is a lot of optimism too behind this incoming generation. So that survey I mentioned we did last year, one of the questions we asked was basically, do you think, like, are you making enough, or do you think you'll make enough to achieve your life goals, right? So in other words, like, are you optimistic? And the majority of farmers we surveyed under 40 years old said yes, right? So, like, they are hopeful. And so, of course, like, that, when you see that, and when I get to travel outside of Washington, D.C., which thankfully is pretty often, you know, you can feel and touch it. And it's amazing. I mean, I encourage, like, anyone to get out there, talk to your young farmers at the farmers market, go out to their farms and visit them. They love it. I mean, that's one of the things we do in the policy advocacy is, like, we invite members of Congress to visit our farmers. And that's when we really start to get somewhere.
Great. Well, Andrew Barenberg, thank you for joining us at Origins. This has been an amazing conversation.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
Yeah, it's crucial, and I appreciate the work you're doing.
Sam.
Yeah.
Thanks for doing what you do.
And thank you for listening to Origins on Full Service Radio.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.